even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. A bit grey today, isn't it?
Well, hello and welcome. I'm here. Hello, everyone. And you're listening to The Deepest Lore. And, well, we're doing something a little bit different today. Some people liked my Wu-Tang Clan stream. Other people did not. And it was specifically because people didn't like it that I've decided to do more. Because that's how... kind of confrontational art works.
Distinctly subversive.
And I'm going to be talking about a band today that can justly lay claim, I think, to being either the world's most obscure band, which is obviously partly not true because they're reasonably famous these days, but also true in the sense that they have something called the theory of obscurity, which I'll talk about in a second. They can also, I think, lay claim to being arguably the weirdest band in the world. And I am talking, of course, about The Residents. Now, what I'm thinking about, so when I did the Wu-Tang Clan stream, one of the reasons I thought, I mean, other than being a fan, of course, I'm a fan of all sorts of music, but I kind of like acts that have a deep lore. And one of the things about the Wu-Tang Clan, as opposed to doing a stream on, let's say, the Notorious B.I.G. or Nas or, you know, any other rap group, is that the Wu have their own kind of inner world, their own lingo, their own lore, and they've made a lot of things themselves. So there's a kind of creative, artistic vision and spirit behind it. And in terms of that, I was thinking, well, I don't know of a group that has a deeper lore than The Residents. So just to have a look at people who, because I don't really have a sense of what people know and what people don't, what I consider obscure and what other people don't. For example, I'm also into, you know, 1930s Delta blues. I'm into 1920s big bands and things like this. And I don't know what people know, and I don't know what people don't know. You know, is Leo Reisman and his orchestra obscure to you? I don't know. Is, I don't know, Blind Lemon Jefferson obscure to you or not? I have no idea what people's perceptions are, especially kids these days, because in my view, kids don't know anything about apart from Harry Potter. But anyway, press one if you have heard of The Residents or if you've ever listened to a Residents album, and press two if you are a total, I have never heard of this group, never seen them, never heard of them, etc. So give me a one if you've heard of them, and give me a two if you're a total noob, so I know where I'm going in. Okay, there's quite a lot of twos, but there's a surprising amount of ones. There is people who've heard of them but not listened to them. Look at Cringe Walker. You're Cringe Walker, I see you there.
Distinctly subversive.
I knew Cringe Walker would have been. He's a subversive character. Now, I have to warn you. I have to warn you all, okay? When I say this band is strange, we have to put things into context, okay? The Residents came out of the fringe counterculture of San Francisco in the 1960s, okay? Now, in order to really understand where The Residents are coming from, okay, we have to map out, I guess, what the culture of that late 1960s period that they came out of may have looked like, okay? So you've heard the term like 60s counterculture, okay? But what was the counterculture that they were reacting to in the 60s, okay? So you have to think like, well, 1950s mainstream culture, Frank Sinatra, crooners, we're thinking about, old-fashioned jazz acts, music hall. I mean, there's a whole smorgasbord of what was mainstream culture, quote unquote, coming out of the 1950s and the early 1960s. And of course, you also have the late 50s rock and roll, Elvis Presley, and all of that scene, which was, I guess, its own kind of nascent counterculture in itself, which became mainstream. But then in the 1960s, the counterculture that people talk about, these days you think of as being very mainstream. Okay, so you have the Bob Dylan, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, the Who, and so on and so forth. All of the 60s acts, and they were at some point considered a counterculture. They were a revolution in the 60s. And then in that San Francisco scene, if you delve a bit, you've got acts like the whole psychedelic crowd, Jefferson Airplane, all those kind of LSD, Love, all of those kind of LSD inspired acts, Janis Joplin, whoever was around then. And they were still part of that kind of countercultural movement, although they were a little bit less mainstream than the Beatles. Okay. Then, if you can imagine, there was a counterculture to that counterculture, which comprised acts such as Frank Zappa, who was weird, okay, and Captain Beefheart, and various other kind of strange acts who spent their time in a way critiquing the counterculture cool kids. Okay, so if you can imagine, there was the old mainstream, there was the 60s reaction against it, and then you had the likes of Zappa and Captain Beefheart who were kind of making fun, or they were making fun of the hippies, or they were critiquing the hippies, or they were they positioned themselves as an alternative, if that makes any sense. Okay. But then, even beyond them, in the distant, even beyond Zappa and Captain Beefheart, in the distant fringes, in some club with, six kind of avant-garde weirdos in San Francisco in 1969, you would have had, coming out of that scene, the Residents, okay? I understand people are thinking, well, the Residents' first album was in 1974. So how could they possibly come out of that scene? Well, the fact is they were around. I think they started in the late 1960s, and they were in and around that scene. They just didn't make any records, okay? Then I think it was 1971, 1972, they famously sent some demo tapes to Warner Brothers. It was so famously bad and so kind of comically awful that the Warner, the Warner Brothers rejected them, essentially. And I think one of the interesting things about the, beyond Beefheart. If somebody's saying I've messed up my timeline, explain to me how I've messed my timeline up. I don't think I have. Now, given that they're coming out of this incredibly subversive 1960 San Francisco scene, and they are, by any account, an extremely subversive band, how how can me, as a as someone who's you know, supposedly on the reaction end of things, find things of value in the residents? Well, the thing is that they're so far on the fringes of things, as we're about to see, that they spend a lot of their time critiquing the very culture that we critique. You know, what we call the boomer truth regime. The residents really are a deconstruction of and a kind of such a radical poking fun of that counterculture, if you want, that came out of the 1960s, and such a violent reaction to it, and such a kind of puncturing of its pretensions that in some ways the residents, I mean, I would not say in any single way that the residents were reactionary, okay, but I would say that some of the implications of where they're going certainly kind of give us quite a radical critique of what we call today Globo Homo, okay? Now, just, yeah, I mean, in some way, people are saying the residents are post-punk, but the residents were post-punk before punk even happened, if that made it, you know, if you can imagine being post-punk in 1974, this is kind of where we're going. Now, I've got lots and lots of songs and clips and things to play, which is why it took time to get things going here. The other thing I want to mention before we start, because I'm going to go through album by album. I don't know how long we're going to, in my mind, I want to go all the way to 2002 and finish on Demons Dance Alone. But in reality, I reckon on this stream, we may reach, I don't know, the end of the 80s or something and run out of time, because I have no idea how much time this is going to take. The residents are still going, believe it or not. They have got literally hundreds and hundreds of EPs, records, albums, compilations, remix tapes, or you name it. They've been going forever. And they're almost like their own kind of little industry. What is interesting about the residents is that after that early rejection from the Warner Brothers, is that they pretty much set up their own production. Okay. The residents not only made all of their own music, they made all of the album cover art. They made all of the packaging. They produced the records themselves, often using hand-pressed vinyl. So there is a very interesting extent to which the residents are a bit like, I don't know, like William Blake. You know, William Blake made his, he actually was involved in the physical production of his own books, and there were only a few copies of them made. So we're getting close. when we're talking about the residents, it's as close in kind of mass consumer culture as you can get to a music act that is making something approaching authentic art objects, i.e. they're not mass produced, or they weren't mass produced back in the day. I mean, to give you an example, right? Their first album, Meet the Residents, I think they only were able to hand press something like 1,000 copies of that album, Meet the Residents. And they only sold in their first year 40 albums. So, you know, when I'm talking obscure, we're talking about an act where their first album sold 40 copies. Okay. So that's, I think, a decent way to get in. Yeah, I can see people comparing them to Devo. And I'm not sure, exactly sure when Devo start. So people are saying their biggest hit. Their biggest hit. Come on. The residents have never had a hit. The closest they've had to mainstream exposure, as we'll talk about in a second, is actually getting play on MTV. Okay, they're probably biggest. Their biggest album is probably Duck Stab, because it got play on kind of various new wave radio stations in 1977, and it led certain kind of DJs and things to in some ways misclassify them as a new wave, as part of that new wave scene, which is hilarious if you think about it. So they actually picked up kind of a bit of a college audience around Duckstar, but we'll get to that in a second. I would say Devo. I'm a fan of Devo and I have all their albums, but I'm not sure if Devo knew the Residents. But certainly, like for example, the Residents have a very interesting cover and deconstruction of Satisfaction by Rolling Stones, and so do Devo. In fact, my favorite version of Satisfaction is by Devo, because you know, when Mick Jagger sings about "I can't get no satisfaction," he's talking from the point of view of being like a kind of a stud in a way, a young, you know, he's literally Mick Jagger. When Devo sing about it, it's you know, they're a group of nerds, so it comes from a very different place. So, and there's a kind of jittery energy in that version of Satisfaction. But yes, I mean, I would say Devo. I mean, if this makes any sense, Devo are kind of much more mainstream kind of idea of what the Residents were doing. Okay, right. So let us make a start. Now, I'm gonna prior warn you here. Okay, I'm gonna prior warn everybody watching this that this music, especially upon first listen, will be jarring. Some of you are gonna hate it. Some of you are gonna think, "What the hell?" Okay. So it's but once you really start to appreciate the Residents, the lore gets deeper and deeper and deeper. Okay, so let me make a start. Then I'm gonna do. I've learned from the Etherstream I did. I've learned from the Wu-Tang stream where I talked about, where I played some of the act and then talked about them. I'm going to do it the other way around here. I'm going to talk about it and then we're going to listen. Okay. Cause I think it's probably more interesting that way around. I can tell you now that at least half, if not 80% of you are going to think that some of the stuff I'm going to play you is hot trash. Okay. People are going to say it's awful. When the Residents started in Meet the Residents, they couldn't actually play any instruments, as we're about to hear. But they were very they're just a very interesting group. So we're going to start with Meet the Residents in 1974. Okay. Now, first of all, this cover, which is the defaced Beatles, you know, it's obviously the Beatles that have been defaced. This really annoyed Capitol Records, famously, and they wanted to take legal action because I know it only sold 40 copies, but it's still, you know, it's like, what, you know, how can you bring out this defaced album cover? And in fact, they were for, I think the Residents had to later on reissue it with the Beatles heads like replaced with prawns and things like that. But anyway, John Lennon actually has had a copy. He bought a copy of Meet the Residents, and apparently he proudly displayed it on his mantelpiece or something. So let's talk a little bit about the genesis of Meet the Residents. Just to understand that the Residents aren't really like they're a band, but they're also like a kind of art they were always launching visual projects, and they were working on a film called Vileness Fats all throughout this period. And I don't think it ever got properly made, this film, or finished, this Vileness Fats, but they took all sorts of things that they had planned for this and ended up spinning various other things from it. Yeah, I mean, the cover, this cover that we're talking about, got almost as much attention as the actual album. And I think it's worth reading the liner notes of this, because the final thing that I have forgotten to mention before we got into the Residents is that their whole gimmick, if you want, is that they are a completely anonymous group. So nobody knows who the four residents are. They're anonymous, okay? And one of the things you'll find is that all of these little concepts that the residents come up with are later stolen by much more famous acts. So, in fact, the Wu-Tang Clan I mentioned last week, do you remember they released that one album that was bought by one person? The residents did that before. They released something where there was only one copy in the world and it was sold for something like £200,000. So, in a way, the Wu-Tang, I don't know if they knew it or not, but the residents had done it first. So there's a little bit of that, you know, Simpsons did it idea. You know, you'll often find the residents did it already. And I mention that because I remember there was that band in the 90s. Was it Slipknot? Was it Slipknot, that bloody band? They were anonymous, like they wore masks and nobody knew who they were. So the residents, the whole idea of them is that nobody knows who they are. Hence, they're the world's most obscure band because nobody knows who they are. And in fact, because John Lennon had a copy of this and because the Beatles were on the front, there were long running rumors that the residents were secretly the Beatles because there were four of them and, you know, nobody who knew who they were. Maybe it was the Beatles having fun type of thing. But this is all just lore. They're not. I think at this point, people know who the residents were. So, just to give you a bit more residents lore before we actually listen to them and read you some of the notes of this first album, the residents had a front group, okay, called the Cryptic Corporation. In fact, they still exist, the Cryptic Corporation. And these were basically kind of public-facing management figures that spoke on behalf of the residents. So the residents would often be talked about in the third person because they didn't give interviews. They didn't, nobody knew who they were. If they did appear in public, they'd wear masks. And these other guys would talk on their behalf. And the four members of the Cryptic Corporation were Homer Flynn, Hardy Fox, chap called Jay Clem. We'll see some of these guys in a moment in various interviews. And the fourth one's name is name escapes me now. Is it John Kennedy? Not that John Kennedy, but another. I think his name was John Kennedy. Okay. And the kind of open secret over the years. I mean, I don't think I'm giving too much away, but I mean, most residents fans think it's more fun to maintain the kind of illusion or the kayfabe that the residents are anonymous, okay? But it's kind of been an open secret for a long time that the Cryptic Corporation, the four members of the management team, were the band, basically, okay? I don't know if they've kind of come out and admitted that at this point, but it's pretty obvious. Hardy Fox unfortunately died 2 years ago, and the residents are still going. One of the supposed members has died, so there's that. But having said that, those four members of the Cryptic Corporation, two of them leave in the early 80s. So from about the mid 80s onwards, the only two like active, there are only two residents, even though they maintain the idea that there's four. So because of this cloak of anonymity, it's easier to think of the residents as a kind of shifting collective of different people. You know, there'll be different people contributing to the projects coming and going. So even though it's probably Flynn and Fox, the idea of the residents as something beyond them still kind of maintained itself, if that makes any sense. Because it's never clear who's playing what, it's never clear who's on the albums, et cetera, et cetera. Although when you start to get to know them, it's pretty obvious. There's a very distinctive lead singer, and when he's on a record, you know it's him all the way through, and we'll see that in a second. As we'll see, Homer Flynn has got, let's just say, some rather unusual facial features, and you know, over the years, this becomes increasingly obvious that, like, who else has ears like this, you know? Anyway, let's not dilly-dally anymore. So I'm going to read you the liner notes of Meet the Residents, because a lot of the Residents stuff is about the concept behind the album. A lot of the ideas behind each of these records are as interesting as the records themselves. It's very arty, all of this, okay? So here are the Residents' original liner notes for Meet the Residents. The Residents began collecting interesting and unusual tapes in the early 60s in an effort to expand their awareness of the very nature of sound. The tapes came from everywhere, cassettes of soldiers in Vietnam, singing songs with impromptu instrumentation, reels from secondhand songs, sound effects and bird call collections from garage sales, and yes, even a few bootleg tapes of well-known pop artists going avant-garde between takes, which were purchased on the black market and stored in a local bank vault, okay? The Residents not only collected other people's tapes, but gained widespread notoriety for their unusual recordings. And this is one of the really interesting things about the Residents, okay? None of these guys knew how to play music, knew how to play any instruments when they started. So they played with things that nobody else was really doing. Like they kind of spliced together tapes and made up sounds and, you know, played non-instruments as instruments and warped tapes, and there's all sorts of innovations in the soundscape that are kind of sonically interesting and unique. Okay, you'll hear things on Residents records where it's like, well, what is that? I mean sometimes it's obvious, well, that's a piano, that's a guitar. At the time, it's like, you know, what are they even playing there? You know, I think on one record, there's like a child's toy, and, you know, there's all sorts of different things. And then later on, as we'll see, they were the owners of the fifth ever EMU, MU emulator. I think they were the owners of the fifth ever one in the world. So, They really did pioneer a lot of stuff. And one of the interesting things that we'll see about the Residents is that they're always early adopters of technologies. They're always like right on the, and because they don't really know what they're doing, they kind of use those things in very unconventional ways. So, you know, the history of the Residents is also like a potted history of music technology and audiovisual technology as well. I mean, I think they brought out their first CD-ROM like way before most people would even have access to a CD-ROM, you know. Anyway, so let's carry on. The Residents not only collected tapes, the underground network carried their reputation across the oceans, where it finally hit the ears of the then unknown Englishman, Snakefinger Lithman, okay? And Snakefinger was actually a very talented slide guitarist, and he appears on a lot of their early records before his unfortunate death in, I think it's 1983, Snakefinger dies. But we'll hear some Snakefinger as we go. Packing a few clothes, Snakefinger flew directly from San Mateo, California, where the Residents then had their sound studios, in hopes of studying tapes of early Cajun music the Residents were alleged to have recorded while in college in Louisiana. Snakefinger had also brought an acquaintance that he had met in the woods of Bavaria while on an expedition there for Britain. That friend was none other than the mysterious Ensenada, who had developed a complex musical system based on phonetics. And this chap the mysterious N. Sanada is like a kind of guru, okay? And like much else in the resident's kind of lore, okay? It's not actually clear if the mysterious N. Sanada was a real person or just someone they'd made up. But this mysterious N. Sanada is the kind of music guru who came up with the theory of obscurity and this phonetic system that kind of acts as a muse for the residents, okay? For 6 months, Snakefinger, the mysterious N. Sanada, who spoke very little English, and the residents worked together recording and listening to tapes. A few lucky people were even able to catch impromptu performances by the mysterious N. Sanada and Snakefinger at several of San Francisco's folk and jazz clubs. I mean, who knows if this is true or made up? Snakefinger was real. The mysterious N. Sanada, I mean, let's just see if there's a picture of N. Sanada. I was actually thinking of releasing the novel that I wrote when I was 18 and using the pseudonym N. Sanada. But let's just have a look. This is the only known photo of the mysterious N. Sanada. Apparently that is him. Whether that is true or not, who knows? But there he is, okay? So let me just continue with my Meet the Residents liner notes. I won't take this long on every album. I'm just kind of setting up your understanding of this rather unusual band. The Residents negotiated with Warner Brother Records executive Hal Halverstad over the rights to the Snakefinger and Sanada Residents tapes. But Warner Brothers hit a slump in record sales and decided the audience appeal was too limited and at the last minute withdrew their offer. Snakefinger returned to England to become a rock and roll star, and the mysterious N. Sanada, well, he just disappeared one day. The residents had ventured to guess that he had probably gone to the Arctic regions because he believes some musical link is hidden among the Eskimos of the frozen north, okay? And this is a foregrounding of a later album that you may have heard about from the residents called Eskimo, which we'll get to in a moment. The music on this album, Meet the Residents, is not that of Snakefinger or of the mysterious N. Sanada. The residents have taken the basic idea of the phonetic organization but have applied the theories to a more Western style of music. The translation does not always hold intact, though there is more than enough example of this staggering new music style. The instruments used on this record have been turned to approximate Western culture harmonies, and artistic freedom is assumed for the right to substitute normal instruments where necessary. Listen closely to the record. Let the strangeness wear off through a couple of plays. Soon you too will whistle the merry tunes and wonder along with the residents who that old man N. Sanada really was. So this is the introduction. Now brace yourselves, folks, because we're about to listen to the residents' cover of Boots by Nancy Sinatra. Okay, get ready for this, folks. This is Boots by the residents. Okay. I cannot wait to see the live reaction to this. I'm just going to let the record play, and I'm going to watch for general reeing in the chat. So this is Boots by the residents. Get ready.
Boots are made for a life. Whoa,
I'm sorry, I'm just still I'm still just watching the reaction there. So that is Boots on Meet the Residents. Now there are some kind of more musical moments on Meet the Residents. So this is Spotted Bean Pinto. Spotted Pinto Bean on the same album. And I won't play all of this, but you can see that there is more musicality on this first album, where they're playing with soundscapes and different instruments and kind of breaking down pop conventions. So let's hear a bit of Spotted Pinto Bean. This is more listener friendly. Okay, we'll leave it there. I won't play the whole 5 minutes of that. But that's Spotted Pinto Bean, and as you can see, a little bit more listener friendly. Okay, yeah, not exactly easy listening. When I said this is the world's, you know, this is probably the most challenging music band you'll ever have to get into. Okay, but I will say that this Meet the Residents album is known as their early primitive period. Chiefly because they didn't really know how to play instruments. And what is really fascinating about them, because remember, this is a group that's made, you know, easily close to 100 albums at this point, is that all of they're kind of self-taught. I don't know if they ever learned how to sing or play instruments. So I think that their music, in a strange way, is a self-generated language. And the Residents are very into making up their own languages and making up their own kind of worlds and concepts, as we'll see. So they do improve from Meet the Residents, okay, in their kind of they improve as musicians as time goes on, as we'll see. But it's kind of interesting that they're so like unschooled, or they're you know, they talk about going your own way, I guess. And this is like an ultimate example of going their own way. Okay, so let us continue. People are calling it postmodern garbage, which it's very funny to me. Okay, so let's hit their second album now, Third Reich and Roll. And once again, I will read the liner notes. Why do the Residents hate the Beatles? It starts. That was a popular question several years ago when Ralph Records released the Residents' first album, Meet the Residents. Not everyone appreciated seeing their Beatle gods treated so non-seriously. The real Beatles, obviously being more intelligent than their fans, thought it was hilarious. Capitol Records, predictably, thought the cover should be changed, so it was. Then there was the second album, Not Available, produced in total secrecy. The album is a conceptualization of the theory of obscurity as applied to phonetic organization, as originally put forth by the Bavarian avant-gardist, the mysterious Ensenada, with whom the Residents worked in the late 1960s. According to the theory of obscurity, the album was not released. However, in 1978, 4 years later, so we'll get on to Not Available in a second, because apparently they recorded Not Available in the gap between Meet the Residents and Third Reich and Roll, but then put it in a vault to be forgotten about and released it 5 years later. Spoilers, everyone. I don't actually believe this story about Not Available, but anyway, lots of fans do believe it. anyway, in a more we'll get back to Not Available in a second. In a more traditional vein, the Residents announced the release of their third LP, The Third Reich and Roll. Already people are speculating whether the Residents are hinting that rock and roll has brainwashed the youth of the world. When confronted with this possibility, they replied, "Well, it may be true or it may not be, but we just wanted to get a kick. We just wanted to kick out the jams and get it on." The Third Reich and Roll consists of two suites, Swastikas on Parade and Hitler Was a Vegetarian. Both are semi-phonetic interpretations of top 40 hits from the 60s. "Our roots," say the Residents, "a bright orange carrot clutched lovingly in their extended hands." So there we go. Now, as you may imagine, Third Reich and Roll produced a little bit of controversy when it came out, because the swastikas that are on the front cover there and in the music video caused the album to be banned in Germany, because, you know, they're not allowed in Germany to have those, so they had to completely redesign the front cover and so on for the German market, apparently. Who in Germany was buying Residents records in 1976? I don't know, but this is part of the law. The other thing I will mention, and this is where the Residents get kind of interesting, is that the Residents were one of the very first music acts to make videos, okay? By videos, I mean like actual music videos as we know them now. Okay, it wasn't the done thing for everybody to just make a video to go along with songs. David Bowie famously made videos, okay, in the 70s, but not everybody did. Okay, so the Residents made a video for Third Reich and Roll, okay, which we're going to watch a little bit of it in a second. Now, there's a couple of deeply subversive points about this, okay. So this video was made kind of on the set of their Vileness Fats film project that was never completed, and they wanted to make a world out of newspapers, okay. But as you can see, the costume resembles the Ku Klux Klan, okay? And this caused much controversy, even in the USA. I say much controversy, like to the point where anybody noticed. People were like, "Hold on a second, is this a Nazi album with KKK members?" So, yeah, so there was much confusion about this aspect. The Residents responded by saying that actually it was nothing to do with that. It was just that this is the only way to make a hat out of newspapers, as you can see. Okay. Well, anyway, because the Residents were one of the few acts like making actual videos, as opposed to just, I mean, you can go back and look. A lot of 70s music videos are just kind of live footage of them singing the song, you know, with the studio version dubbed on top of it. But because the Residents were one of the few acts who were like making artistic videos of this kind, when MTV started in 1984, 1985, they were struggling to fill the time. Okay, they were struggling to fill up like the 24 hours of music videos that they had to put on. So the Residents, because they actually had videos, kept on making it onto, you know, they were like, "Well, we've got these videos from the Residents. We'll, you know," so they ended up getting onto MTV. But it's like, well, now you've got like MTV kids watching Third Reich and Roll and stuff like this. So as we'll see, there are a couple of strands that run through the Residents' career. One of those strands is doing these very avant-garde, primitivist deconstructions of pop. They do a lot of pop deconstruction. And that, we'll get on to some of the other strands later on. But here on Third Reich and Roll, this is their first real foray into doing these kind of avant-garde. I mean, you could say deconstruction, or you could just say destruction. But it's kind of interesting because they're using this what they're trying to say with this is that the counterculture of the 1960s and pop music and the whole what we today would call the culture of the globo homo, you know, they're trying to say that in itself is totalitarian, if that makes any sense. So their point in making this album wasn't to, you know, it has nothing to do with the Nazis, really. What they were trying to say was that the kind of culture that they find themselves in America at that time was in itself totalitarian. I hope that makes sense. All right, let's I'll let this play out and see how people react. So here's Hitler Was a Vegetarian. This is the finale of Third Reich and Roll. Yes, this was on MTV, believe it or not. So let's carry on. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if people can pick up on what the song they're covering is. I mean, this is pretty obvious to me, but let me know if you can see what they're deconstructing in each of these kind of movements of this track. That's right, Sunshine of Your Love. Yeah. Yeah, you picked up on Hey Jude. Yeah, well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's the Rolling Stones that's come in. People have spotted. You're right. Yeah, I can see people saying B-Fart is normie compared to this. I mean, yes. All right, so let's carry on with our journey through the fucking weird and wacky world of the Residents. So they followed up Third Reich and Roll with Fingerprints in 1977. I don't have many notes for this one. This is where they were kind of, this is kind of a transitional album because they have quite a kind of marked shift in their sound over the next few years. And as we'll see when it comes to the Residents, their kind of vision and what they're trying to do oscillates wildly from album to album, even though there are conceptual through lines as we'll see. So I won't linger too long on Fingerprints. There is a little bit of lore here because when the Residents recorded Fingerprints, they intended it to be the world's first three-sided LP. So they wanted to make back in the day when you had vinyl, there was an A side and you'd play a certain amount of time and then you'd have to flip it over and then you'd play the second half. So there was a kind of form where you had, a natural start and end of side one and then a natural start and end of side two. And what the Residents wanted to do is bring out the world's first three-sided LP. However, they said they ran into practical difficulties with trying to make a three-sided record after experimenting with making a triangle and various other things. And so in the end, and that three-sided LP was meant to be called Tourniquet of Roses. So instead, they just released it as a conventional two-sided LP. And we'll just hear a little bit of Fingerprints. I don't have much. It's kind of an important album in their musical journey, but it's kind of stepping stone to more interesting things, I would say. So let's just hear Tourniquet of Roses on Fingerprints. I won't play it all. We'll just hear a little bit of it. There's no video for this one, sadly. So So you can see that, you know, this is starting to resemble a bit more of kind of normal song structure now, and they're writing their own, you know, rather than doing these pop deconstruction covers, they're writing their own songs again. So this album, Fingerprint, is a transition that gets us onto what would become a signature sound for them on their next album. Because I spent a long time setting things up here, so I want to make sure that I want to get at least to the end of the 80s here. But ideally, my destination is 2002. But anyway, their next album, Duckstar, Buster and Glenn. They originally brought out an EP called Duckstab that was 7 songs long, but then they had a follow-up EP called Buster and Glenn, and they ended up the sound quality of the original Duckstab wasn't great, so they ended up repressing it and bringing out this album, Duckstab, Buster and Glenn. And amazingly for the residents, they managed actually to get radio play. When I say radio play, I mean underground kind of radio, avant-garde state. But they managed to get somewhat on the radar with this album. Now it is, Duckstab, I would never say it's more commercial, but it's more listenable, as you'll see. And it's a very signature sound. If anybody's actually heard The Residents, the likelihood is that Duckstar will be the album that you would have heard, because various different tracks of theirs got some cut through. And I want to say there's even been some cover versions. There's a song called Constantinople that they do. And I want to say that They Might Be Giants had their own version of Constantinople at one point. But anyway, let's have a look at let's have a look at the track Lizard Lady from Duckstab, and you'll see the development of the soundscape, and you'll see that this is a more sinister sound, but it's more conventionally resembling music at this point. So let's have a look at Lizard Lady.
What's a woman going to do but throw away her bread? You're feeling funny as she lies beneath the bed. She reminisces of the pungent Adriatic Sea. She crawls and counts her hands, which is like a flea. What she really likes to do is sit upon a pew. Make believe in time is stopped and motionless as you. Planes are stranded in the sky and drains are stopped too. She alone is laughing under eyelids full of food. She scurries, hurries, worries that the wicked will receive their candy from a handsome man and coffee from a thief. She gazes at an hourglass and asks it if it cares, and then she wonders if the lizard likes his lettuce fare.
Lizard? Yeah, the lizard. A lizard of the sea. It conspicuously alcoholic licks his tongue at me. Release me, lizard, licking lizard, lizard of the bee. Moist is out of stock, you still dare me to die. Dare me to die at all. Coating all my lips with honey, sticky coating, coating honey. Flee of lizard, fly. Stop and fly, flicker tongue is licking after by me. Feel me, hide, hide from the tongue.
So that was a Lizard Lady from Duckstab, possibly their most mainstream album. Certainly probably their best known album, if anybody has heard of it. There was a music video to come out of Duckstab, Buster and Glenn, which we're going to play. There's an interesting little bit of There's an interesting bit of lore behind this video, which I'm about to play. The video is called Hollow Skinny. Okay. This is from Duckstab. And this again got play on MTV, believe it or not. Let me just read the lore. Let me just read some of the lore of this short film here. It was made by the residents and an artist called Graham Whiffler. Okay. It stars. So the person you're about to see in this is called Bridget Terrace. Okay. Bridget Terrace was a real guy that the residents found in a kind of home. You know, he was a disabled man, and the residents chance across this disabled chap, Bridget Terrace. Okay, when I say disabled, he was mentally disabled. He was disturbed. This man, Bridget Terrace, lived under the impression that he was the actress Brigitte Bardot. Okay, Bridget had been released from a local mental institution as a result of then Governor Ronald Reagan's budgetary cuts. Okay, so this guy who lived believing he was Brigitte Bardot was just kind of wandering the streets of San Francisco, and the residents kind of found him. Unfortunately, during the filming of this, Bridget ran off. He just kind of disappeared. So they don't actually have they didn't complete the filming, so they had to kind of reuse some of the stock here. But let's have a look at this one of the famous residents videos, Hollow Skinny.
So incredibly thin that even the end of an eyedropper sucked him in. Now Skinny never knew any questions, and Skinny never looked at lights, but Skinny sold something every single night. Skinny sold a soldier to me, Skinny sold a wife, Skinny sold a suction cup and a knife. Skinny found a Hello Dolly record in the hall. He sold it to a truck driver in the fall.
That was Hollow Skinny by the residents from Duckstar, Buster, and Glenn. So, yeah, it's the most fun I'm having is just watching watching reactions in the chat to each of these. So, anyway, let's carry on with our journey, because the next album was the aforementioned Not Available. Now, there's quite a bit of lore behind this, because I will just read the liner notes. For this is provided by the Cryptic Corporation. They say Not Available was not meant to be released, hence the title Not Available. It was an attempt to take N. Sanada's theory of obscurity to its logical conclusion. Sanada maintained that an artist does his or her best work in isolation, free from the influence of an audience. If the artist is modifying his or her ideas to suit the tastes of the audience, the work is being corrupted. Now, I would love to put that theory to John Dee, one of the few artists I know, because I'd just be interested to know his taste about, to know his take on what knowledge of an audience does to artistic work. Because it's kind of an interesting, I mean, who knows if Ensenada or this theory of obscurity is real or not, but it's an interesting thing to consider in and of itself. Anyway, the album was not to be released until the band themselves had forgotten completely about its existence. So there would be no potential audience to influence its development. The idea worked well. The music in Not Available, a mini opera made up of four acts with an epilogue, is excellent and very distinctive. The eventual publication of Not Available came about as the result of a problem with the band. In 1978, the residents were working on Eskimo, the much-touted major release. However, after a disagreement with the Cryptic Corporation, the band disappeared to England with the Eskimo master tapes. Needing something to release, the Cryptics pulled some old tapes off the shelves and released them as Not Available, complete with ads in the UK music press announcing now it can be sold. The residents weren't bothered much by this deviation from their plan. However, since the 1978 decision by someone else to release the album couldn't affect their philosophical conditions under which it was recorded in 1974. Now, that is the lore behind this album and the kind of official residence kayfabe explanation for it. A bit of a conspiracy theory. I've put this to other residence fans back in the day, and they thought I was a loon, and they were like, how dare you not believe the official version type thing. But I don't believe this album was recorded in 1974. Okay. Remember what the Residents sounded like in 1974 on Meet the Residents, you know, that cover of Boots I played, and you know how I don't believe that the Residents were good enough to play this music in 1974. So I believe they made it in 1978. But the official idea is that it was in a vault, never to be seen again for 5 years, and then it was taken out. So with all of that said, let's hear a little bit of Edwina, the opening track from Not Available. I will say that this is one of my favorite Residents albums, Not Available. I think it's very interesting. It has very long tracks, but let's hear a bit of Edwina. Thank you. So you can hear that the you know they're building up a soundscape here. I'll just skip it on a bit so you can hear some of the vocals as they come through. I would recommend the best way of listening to this album is get yourself a really expensive set of headphones and listen to it in the pitch, you know, listen to it in the pitch black, you know, darkness on your own. This is the best way to listen to this album. I mean, I'd love a musician to break down what all of these instruments are. Someone like, you know, JS, a musician I know who watches this channel. Like, what is this instrument here?
On to pollination is a gracious thing, a stirring and a whirring and a broken widower's pain. It's causing easy heart to just leave a lust alone. But when a friend has shrunk one skin, where do you grow the bone? Do you grow the bone? Do you grow the bone?
Okay, so that's one of my favorite Residents albums there, Not Available. Okay, so let us move on now to another really famous, I say famous by their standards, very famous album of theirs, Eskimo. Among other things, it was famous for introducing this signature look, the eyeballs in the tuxedos. The Residents didn't really have an image before Eskimo, but since this front cover, they then donned these eyeball heads, and if they were ever seen in public, this is how they would be seen, with these eyeballs. And it's not uncommon to see the Residents referred to as the eyeballs. It's one of their nicknames. So this album Eskimo has quite a lot of lore behind it, and it is a wild departure from the sort of stuff that we were hearing on Duckstab and elsewhere. So in 1979, punk music was all the rage. The Residents had gone through their punk stage 3 years earlier with their cover of Satisfaction, which I mentioned, and were ready for anything that was not punk. So basically they put this out as a kind of F you to punk. I will just read this line. I'll read their own notes, okay? Because I do think the concepts behind these albums and the stories behind them are part, like, with a lot of music, you don't need to know any of this stuff. But with the Residents, the kind of lore and the kind of stories behind it are part of the artwork, if that makes any sense. So you have to know the concept and you have to know the story. So anyway, here's the Eskimo backstory. Created over a period of 3 years, work began shortly after the third Rock and Roll was released. Eskimo was unlike anything anyone had heard before. Instead of an album made up of songs, the Residents produced a series of acoustic soundscapes. Each track is the sound of a story taking place, rather than the traditional song telling a story. The idea for the album is supposed to have come from the band's former collaborator, the mysterious N. Sonata, who had disappeared in the early 70s to search for music among the Eskimos. Legend has it that he reappeared during the making of the album with a tape of sound samples and a jar of Arctic air to record. The residents teamed up with drummer Chris Cutler and Don Preston, formerly a keyboard player for Frank Zappa's Mothers of Invention, as well as their regular collaborator, Snakefinger. Inspired by such pieces of pop culture as the famous Santa Claus Coca-Cola ads, the residents set about inventing an anthropological background for their Eskimos, which didn't bear much resemblance to reality, but instead was based on pop perceptions of the northern peoples. Nevertheless, the USSR released... nevertheless, in the Soviet Union, the release was classified as a cultural documentary. Each track relates a story which was told in writing on the inside of the album's gatefold cover. The stories are progressively more complex and dig deeper into the fictional Eskimo culture, starting with a simple walrus hunt and ending with a confrontation with the spirit world and a festival of death celebrating the end of the sixth month night. The album shows, as did the mini ballet Six Things to a Cycle on Fingerprints, the influence of Harry Parch. Like Parch, the residents invented their own language and instruments. Most of the fake Eskimo tongue is made up of highly distorted English and is sung while breathing. Most of the fake Eskimo tongue is made up of highly distorted English and is sung while breathing in to give it an alien texture. As the album progresses, you can hear the slow invasion of American culture into the Eskimo lives as the Eskimo spiritual leader, the Angakok, leads them in chants whose nonsense language becomes corrupted with phrases such as Coca-Cola adds life. Eskimo almost didn't happen. When Duckstab turned into a big success, the cryptic corporation started to promote it heavily. The residents became worried that the business may have been moving too quickly, not to mention the possibility that the promotions might engender their anonymity. The residents were already afraid that Eskimo might turn out to be dull and pretentious, so they grabbed the master tapes and disappeared, fleeing to England. Desperate for some material to release, the band disappeared the day before the tapes were ready to go to pressing. The Cryptics pulled an old master tape off the shelves and released that instead, and that album in the law was not available. Okay, it turned out the group had flown to England and left the tapes with Chris Cutler, the aforementioned drummer. John Kennedy and Jay Clem of the Cryptic Corporation flew over to collect the tapes, which Cutler had been keeping at the National Safe Deposit Box Company in London. The New Wave Press, which had become rather caught up in the residents after Duckstab, were quite keen on the whole disappearing resident story. So the corporation milked the event for its publicity value, playing up the mystery of the residents' disappearance and releasing press photos of the tape exchange. And I have that photo is here if you want to see the photo of the... There's the tape. There's Chris Cutler handing over the tape to John Kennedy of the Cryptic Corporation. The legendary Eskimo tape there was found. So you can see... you know, the lore is quite deep behind each of these. And bizarrely, for an album this kind of anti-commercial, and bizarrely for an album like this, it ended up selling out 10,000 copies of its first Snow White vinyl, sold out very quickly. And I think in total they sold something like 30,000 to 60,000 copies of Eskimo, which by their standards was massive sales, okay? So this is not a video that the residents themselves made. I think some dude on YouTube has kind of put visuals together with, you know, part of Eskimo. But let's hear a little bit of this soundscape on Eskimo. All right. Okay, so you get an idea of what Eskimo is like, and that one is quite critically lauded, actually. Eskimo, typically you'll see that one given 5 stars, even in like mainstream music publications and things like that. Yeah, somebody said it's not quite Oasis, is it? Well, indeed. So far, I think we are laying some elements in place for enduring themes in the Residents kind of oeuvre. Okay, this stream is not pre-recorded. The Wooster, I can see you. It's not pre-recorded. Yes. So I'll do super chats at the end. Okay. So let's break down some of the elements that make up what the Residents do. Okay. So the first element, I would say, is primitivism and their interest in, like approximations of tribal musics and things like this. They explore this on Eskimo. It's on the first album. It's on, elements of it are on Third Reich and Roll. So that's one strand, I would say, is their interest in soundscapes and primitivism. Okay. A second strand is deconstruction of pop culture and deconstruction of pop songs and pop form. Okay. Critiques of rock, music industry and so on and so forth, mainstream culture, deconstruction. I would say that's a second strand. And a third strand, is that kind of, how can I say, like the more kind of sinister songwriting that we see on Duckstab. Okay. Those I would say are the three core elements of what make up, you know, what the Residents get up to a lot of the time. Once you see those elements, and they combine in different ways, but as we'll see, this sets a template going forward. Now, I'm going to get on to another of my favorite albums here. And this is another one that it's possible people will have heard of. So this is the Commercial album. Okay. And I'm just going to get up some lore here, because I would say, in terms of concept albums, this concept album, the Commercial album, is one of my favorite concepts ever for an album. Okay. I'll just read their liner notes for the Commercial album. Okay. It just goes like this. Point one, pop music is mostly a repetition of two types of musical and lyrical phrases, the verse and the chorus. Point two, these elements usually repeat 3 times in a 3-minute song, the type usually found on top 40 radio. Point three, cut out the fat and a pop song is usually only 1 minute long. Then record albums can hold their own top 20 minutes per side. Point four, 1 minute is also the length of most commercials and therefore their corresponding jingles. Point five, jingles are the music of America. Conclusion, this compact disc is terrific in shuffle play. To convert the jingles to pop music, program each song to repeat 3 times. So that's where that's the liner notes. So the idea is that each one of these is the core idea of a pop song reduced to 1 minute. And that if you wanted to turn it into a pop song, you just repeat that song three times in a row. Okay. Now, the Residents made made videos for several of the tracks on the commercial album that was later released as a collection called One Minute Movies. Okay. And as we'll see, this is probably their most accessible. It is definitely one of my favorite Residents albums, but it's a much more accessible sound because they are in full pop deconstruction mode here. So let's watch. There are going to be four songs in here, each of them about a minute long. But the whole album, I think it's got 40 tracks, and each one of them is like, it's almost like the Residents' own version of whatever the current top 40 singles happen to be. Okay. So it's a very, very clever album. And I actually think a lot of the songs are pretty good on here, but let's have a watch of the 1 minute movies.
Someone saw a stranger mount, put moisture on her lips, and it was also seen upon her arms and on her hips. No one knows exactly who she was or how she died, but when they opened up her purse, they found a snail inside. I found her crying in the morning, sitting in a chair. She was wrapping something up and wrapping it with care. I did not mean to hurt her when I fell asleep last night. I was just exhausted from the act of being polite. Yes, I was just exhausted from the act of being polite.
Are you enjoying these? Let's carry on.
There's something I must say. The only really perfect love is one that gets away. Thank you.
We are simple, you are simple, life is simple too. We are simple, you are simple, life is simple too.
So there we go. That was the simple song. That's it, I believe. Okay, so I think I'll play one more song from the commercial album. Years later, they released something called the commercial DVD, where they had like different artists make videos for them. So these aren't videos by the Residents; they're videos by various different artists. I'm just going to play the track "My Second Wife" from there as well, because they're only very short, so we can sample little bits of the commercial album. So let's do that. Then I think we'll watch a few like snippets of interviews with the Residents, so you can see like what they were like in a kind of interview setting, and then we'll carry on with the 1980s. So and then let's see how far we get. So here's My Second Wife. Oh, it was made by the Residents.
Yesterday my second wife fell in the afternoon, slipped into the stereo and talked about the moon. Well, this was only temporary, so the doctor said. So I watched the football game and she went off to bed.
That was My Second Wife. All right. So let us continue then. What I want to do now is I just want to have a little look at how the Cryptic Corporation interacted with the press as kind of front spokespeople for the Residents, and what the Residents were like in kind of interview situation. So we're not going to watch them all. We're just going to watch like little snippets. So this, let's have a look. Where do we have, not that one. Okay. So let's start with, Cryptic Corporation member Jay Clem, talking on a show called Video West, in some obscure show on a local station in the 70s. So let's have a watch of this.
On the other side of the musical spectrum lies the Residents. These four multi-talented artists from San Francisco have released 6 albums and 3 EPs since 1974 and are generally acknowledged to be one of the weirdest bands in existence today. The Residents founded Ralph Records in 1972 and have since used it as a vehicle for their works, all of which are based on the theory of obscurity.
The theory of obscurity proper is an artistic theory. There's a system built upon this theory, the main premise of which is that the artist is doing what he's doing for himself, and primarily, and with a minimum amount of input and or feedback from the outside.
For the entire 10 years that the Residents have been in existence, they've steadfastly refused to reveal their identities.
This is sort of an extension of the theory of obscurity put into practical use. They have the idea that by remaining anonymous, they remain less subjective to immediate feedback from other people who might, you know, influence what they do.
In fact, they've only performed live twice in the last 10 years, affecting strange, heavy disguises.
What she really likes to do is sit upon a pew, make-believe and kind of stop in motionless. Planes are straight ahead in the sky.
Let's just see what else they have to say here.
Most of their music revolves around a portion of the theory of obscurity called phonetic organization.
Well, it's a way of arranging sounds. It's a technique by which the residents do records. And like I say, simply, it just means the organization of sound. More generally, it means that a musician or a recording artist, whatever, need not necessarily follow the established rules of music. Theoretically, you can take any group of sounds and organize them in an interesting manner. And this is what the residents try to do. There's a certain basic primitive quality to all the residents' work. They rely more on the primal instincts and, you know, corresponding to the you know, tribal cultures like Africa, South America, or North Pole, whatever. You know, the percussion and basic beat is a rudimentary, you know, concept involved in earlier forms of music.
And yet, their process is at the state of the art of today's technology.
The resident's work of art is indeed the record itself. And the creative process is done in the studio. The main instruments used are, in fact, the studio and its various components. It's hard to say that this is music or art for the future, but obviously it's not for the future because it happened yesterday. So it's for now, or in fact, it's old, because by the time somebody's heard it, it's already been done. But in a relative sense, if indeed the mass populace is here, then the residents are in the future.
So that was Jay Clem from the Cryptic Corporation. Let's have a look at a couple of other little interview appearances before we carry on. Bizarrely, they appeared on Penn and Teller. They seem to be friends with Penn and Teller randomly. So here's an appearance with them in 1982.
The room right now, because right now we are going to show you who the residents are, what they look like, and how they make that music. Ready? We're at a pub in Brixton where the residents, relaxing before their European tour, are playing a game of snookers. I really wish you could be here alive. You could cut the ear with a knife. The excitement is devastating. The residents are, for the first time in history, watching their own video on the screen and seeing what it is they look like. We're watching my first shot at the mole game here. The residents developed a pocket video game that I'm trying to play. The residents get many letters from England asking how to dance to their records. We have some footage here of the residents dancing, and I think if you look at this, you'll be able to put on your own eyeball head and dance up a storm. Besides being sporty,
so there's a bit of that random appearance with Penn and Teller. Now I'm going to find one other little interview appearance they had. This is Homer Flynn of the Cryptic Corporation with an interview on City Limits. Let's have a little look at this.
For the band to this country, we believe?
Definitely. It is definitely the first visit. And
note the ears on, just go back a second. Note the ears on Homer Flynn. This is where it becomes pretty, like, this is, guy's got a very strange look. And he is very, very obviously the lead singer of the Residents. Doesn't take a genius to figure that out. But anyway, let's carry on.
The first visit. And if the reception in Toronto is anything like the one in Montreal, the band will be back just as quickly as possible. It was a great reception in Montreal.
Oh, terrific. We're glad to hear that, because I know that performing is not something that the Residents usually do. They're more of a recording act, we understand, and video makers.
Historically, they are definitely a recording act, as well as video makers, but their interest in performing live has really increased a lot over the last few years, and so I think there're probably going to be more performances and more concerts, but it's a pretty unpredictable situation, so we'll just have to see.
Now, Ralph Records is based in San Francisco, we understand, and there are also other artists signed to the label, like Tuxedo Moon and Snake Finger, and you also distribute records through Ralph. How does the Cryptic Corporation and Ralph Records, how does that all work?
Well, the Cryptic Corporation did own Ralph Records up until about 6 months ago, and we recently sold it to the man who was the sales manager, and really he's running Ralph Records now. The Cryptic Corporation actually are the managers for the Residents. We really handle all their business affairs. When they have projects, like there's a big video project that we've been trying to get financing on for some time now, and we've been handling all the details on that. We set up the tours for them, produce the videos for them. So we generally handle all their business aspects, as well as doing some projects on our own. But the Residents are mainly what we're concentrating on right now.
So I'll just stop it there. But you can see that the Cryptic Corporation are part of the management company, and this idea of the act and the label and so on is part of their deconstruction of the music industry as well. So it's all part of the concept. All right. So let's move on now to the next album and chapter of the Residents' career, because I would say this early period here, from Meet the Residents to the commercial album, represents what people would think of as the classic Residents' period. This is their early hot streak, if you want, and these are arguably their most famous albums, these first seven here, okay? What happened then is that in the early 80s, they embarked on something called the Mole Trilogy. Okay, there's a lot of lore behind this. But this Mole Trilogy also spawned a very, very expensive live show called The Mole Show. Okay, the first album was The Mark of the Mole. The second one was the Tunes of Two Cities. And the third one, bafflingly called Part 4 of the Mole Trilogy, was called The Big Bubble. I think the Mole Trilogy was meant to have six parts or something, but they only ever released three. And so basically, the Moles are a group. They're a kind of tribe represented here by this mole. And I'll just read out some of the lore, okay? Here's some of the lore behind the Mole Trilogy. Now, I would say that the reason that the commercial album marks the end of what is known as their classic period is because this Mole Show almost bankrupted the Residents, okay? It was very expensive. They ended up making a loss on their tour. And famously, Jay Clem and John Kennedy fell out with Homer Flynn and Hardy Fox. Okay, so at some point during the Mole Show tour, the two of the original members of the Crypto Corporation, Clem and Kennedy left the band. Okay, so this Mole trilogy was a very expensive, very it was the kind of classic like they had problems when they went on tour, and really the first iteration of the band, the classic foursome, if you want, ends in the middle of the Mole trilogy, in the middle of this Mole show. And after the Mole trilogy, the Residents go on to be like a, I don't want to say like a different band, but they go off in a slightly different direction, as we'll see. The Mole show marks the end, I would say, of the first lineup, if you want to put it that way, at least of the Cryptic Corporation. Who knows who the Residents are? Anyway, so because as you saw there in that interview, like, it can't be Homer Flynn because you saw the four Residents behind him, right? So Mark of the Mole was planned as the first part of the Mole trilogy. The Mark of the Mole draws on tales from the Great Depression, such as John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. It opens up with a radio broadcast narrated by Penn Jillette. Okay, so there's where the Penn and Teller connection comes in. They hired Penn, or they got Penn Jillette to do the narration on Mark of the Mole, okay? It warns about a storm brewing over the lands, which contain the tunnels of Molamet. The Molamet are a strange race of cloaked figures who prefer to live underground and who are known as the Moles as a result. The storm arrives quickly and floods the Moles out of their homes, forcing them to migrate across the desert to the sea, where the Chubbs live. And these are the Chubbs down here. You can see on the front cover of the Tunes of Two Cities, the Chubbs, okay? The Chubbs are a chubby, vacuous people who live for pleasure in a cozy pop culture. They embrace the arriving Moles, seeing them as a good source of cheap labor. The hard-working Moles soon alienate the Chubbs, however. The latter start to complain about the Moles making all the good work and, sorry, the Chubbs start to complain about the Moles taking all the good work and marrying the Chubbs' daughters, okay? Then, in the Tunes of Two Cities, so on the Mark of the Mole, we get the music from the Mole side, okay? Sorry, on the Mark of the Mole, you hear, and the music is more towards that kind of tribal Eskimo sound that they explore, okay? Then on the Tunes of Two Cities, we get music both from the Mole side and from the Chubb side. It's kind of interesting. The music of the Chubbs is a kind of fluffy Art Deco. It's a superficial music, and the music of the Moles is dark and tribal. And what happens on the Tunes of Two Cities is that we oscillate. We get a Mole track and then we get a Chubbs track, and it goes back and forth. The Chubbs are only concerned with leisure and they want nothing to do with real world problems. To emphasize this, many of the Chubb tracks are mutated covers of escapist big band songs from the 1920s and the 1930s. For example, Mousetrap and Happy Home, a cover of Stan Kenton's Eva Beaver, Smack Your Lips, Clap Your Teeth is a version of The Mood. The Moles, meanwhile, are tribal, hardworking, and they worship a dark god called the Evil Disposer. The music of their songs features the Harry Parch influence, use of invented instruments and language, as the Residents' other tribal culture album, Eskimo. So you get their pop deconstructions here, but they're deconstructing 1920s and 1930s kind of big band music on the Chubb side of the record. And then on the Mole side of the record, we get a continuation of the Eskimo stuff. And then the Big Bubble, which I've listened to less than the others, I must admit. It basically expands, like it carries on the story, basically. The Big Bubble are a band who escape from prison in this world of the Moles and the Chubbs. And we get a kind of synthesis of the Mole music and the Chubb music together, okay? So What I'm going to do to have a look at the Mole trilogy is that we're going to actually watch a little bit of their much much publicized disastrous Mole tour, where we'll get a bit of the Mole music, we'll get a bit of the Chubb music, and you know, you can make your own mind up about what you think of all of this. I believe this is music from the Mole side. We'll hear some Chubb side music in a second. I want to keep on watching until you get to hear Chubb's tunes, because they're so different, but I'm sure Chubb's tune will come on soon. Still mole music. Okay, I think we're going to get a Chubb's tractor. What's so interesting here is that I'm betting the people who were alienated by the mole music are being like, oh, this sounds a bit better, but this is the vacuous pop side of the record. Face it, you're all Chubbs, you're all Chubbs. Okay, I think that's enough for the mole show. Okay, so what did do you know? I've just got my text saying I'm eligible for the vaccine. Shit, what do I do now? Don't know what to do about that. Okay, shall I play my? I'll play my favorite Chubbs track. Shall I? Let's see if I can find this. Favorite, what's it called? Smack Your Lips, you know, the pure bubblegum of the of this. Let me see if I can find Smack Your Lips. Here we go. Chubbs music. This is the sort of music you guys like. This is exactly you. Let's play Smack Your Teeth, sort of bubblegum pop that you feel safe with, a lot of you. Here we go. This is all of you. All of you. Smack your lips, clap your teeth. This is the music that you all want, that you crave for. Is literally dancing around your room right now. Let us continue. Let's continue our little journey then. What have we got now? So They then embarked. So they then embarked after this little bust up within the band. They returned somewhat to their roots and did more of their third Rock and Roll style deconstructions of, you know, classic rock, I guess. They made one album called George and James and another album called Stars and Hank Forever. I think it was George Gershwin and James Brown. That's the covers on the first album. And then the Stars and Hanks, I forget who the Stars part is. The Stars and Hank Forever is, the Stars part is Philip Sousa and Hank Williams and the other one is Hank Williams. Okay. I have decided we're not going to dwell too long on these albums because I want to move on, but I have decided to play you their cover of Man's World by James Brown. This is a Man's World by James Brown. So here is the Residents cover of Man's World. Get ready for this. I'd say this is one of their most conventional ever straight up covers, to be honest. Thank you. So that was Man's World by the Residents from I think from their album George and James. And then they did another album in this kind of vein, which was called The King and I, which was again an album of Elvis covers and deconstructions and so on. And I have picked out actually a live version of Jailhouse Rock, so you can hear the Residents do a bit of Elvis. So let's hear the residents or see the Residents do Jailhouse Rock. Let's check this one out. This you can see here in the kind of mid and late 80s that they were just I get the impression that during this period they were, how can I say, like recuperating, recovering after the disaster of the Mole Show and, you know, losing two of the original members and so on. So this is a kind of like back to basics little period for the Residents here in the mid to late 80s, I feel. And then they tend, when the 90s come around, they get like deeply into MIDI and CD-ROM and playing with visuals again. So anyway, let's have a look at Jailhouse Rock. I actually think this is one of their better cover albums, cover versions ever, actually. So let's hear it. Get ready to dance around the room, Chubbs. So that was Jailhouse Rock by the Residents. What do you reckon? Ratings out of 10, everyone? That was one of their better covers, to be honest. Still a lot of people not happy in the chat, but there we go. So I'm not gonna go in depth over the 90s because I want to finish up. I think we're gonna get to Demons Dance Alone here. Let's just I won't pause on each one of these. I'll just because I feel like when we get to the 90s, they may be starting to run out of ideas a little bit. But we have, there's an album I've actually forgot to put on here called God in Three Persons. There's God in Three Persons, which somehow I've left off. Our Finest Flowers were like kind of reimaginations of their first 20 years. So this is like a kind of, it's not a greatest hits. It's a it's all new tracks, but it was put out as a kind of greatest hits thing. So in the mid 90s, they got very interested in the CD-ROM as an audio visual thing. And they actually started making video games. They put out a CD-ROM of this thing, Freak Show. They had a video game called Bad Day in the Midway or something. Bad Way in the Midday, something like that. Anyway, these two albums, Freak Show and Gingerbread Man, I think Gingerbread Man also had like a CD-ROM that came out with it, where they play with computer graphics and things like this. They're actually quite enjoyable albums, but for my money, they're starting to be kind of, you know, stereotypically weird for the sake of it at this point in the 90s. But let me know what you think of this. I'm not that keen on this little period of the Residents here, but they still have some interesting moments. So let's watch some of Harry the Head. Everyone come to the Freak Show. Harry the Head from Freak Show here. Let's have a little look at this. These are videos that they made themselves on the CD-ROM.
Harry, 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 step right up and you will see on display some of the strangest specimens ever gathered together, both live and preserved.
The idea of Freak Show, by the way, is that they're going. There's a song about various different members of the Freak Show, like Harry the Head. Let me just read out the title. You know, the tracks on Freak Show. Everybody comes to the Freak Show. Harry the Head, Herman the Human Mole, Wanda the Worm Woman, Jack the Boneless Boy, Benny the Bouncing Bump, Mickey the Mumbling Midget, Lily, and Nobody Laughs When They Leave. Those are the tracks. So each of the tracks is a kind of character study of one of these freaks in the Freak Show. So let's have a watch.
From the 1850s to the 1950s, there were many traveling freak shows constantly touring America. These freak shows glorified and romanticized human deformity by exhibiting certain individuals afflicted by disease, birth defects, or accidents as freaks. These traveling freak shows may not have been the perfect solution to an imperfect situation, but at least they offered these unfortunates a good income and camaraderie of their own kind. In these more enlightened times, modern medical science has eliminated most of the human oddities either through abortion or corrective surgery. When these curiosities do manage to be born or created through accident or disease, society has decided that it is wrong to exploit these people, and perhaps that is a noble attitude. but perhaps too, it is a denial of the ugliness and deformity that we normal people feel within. In an increasingly homogenized and conformist culture, we have become afraid of the distorted reflection we see in freaks, and at the same time, we deny them the ability to exploit what may be seen as their only gift. We may no longer condone exhibition of human oddities, but the freaks still get stared at. The only difference is they no longer get paid for it.
You can see there's a very heavy MIDI sound in this 90s period here.
The head was hardly human. The head is finally dead.
I am
So this is a much more polished sound in this period, as you can see. So this is a distinct, I would say there are maybe four distinct periods in the Residents' career. The early classic period that I talked you through, that kind of 80s period when they were doing the Mole Show and then all those covers albums, kind of a bit in no man's land there. This 90s to Demons Dance Alone period, which is very polished, kind of almost like getting, I wouldn't say mainstream, but you know, it's getting more towards a kind of slicker sound. And then the post Demons Dance Alone period, where they're more on the internet and embrace that. We're not going to cover that last period today, but I want to get to Demons Dance Alone. But you can distinctly hear, you know, a much more polished sound from the Residents here. But they're much more interested in narrative storytelling during this period.
Rolled around and found a little paintbrush by the door. As he held it in his teeth, he painted angels on the skirt I wore.
It was hardly human. The head is finally dead.
I can live forever in Allah.
He said.
Okay, so you get the idea. All a freak show sounds a bit like that, and it's it's more listenable. Than when I say more listenable, it's more conventionally listenable, I would say, than some of their earlier work. And Gingerbread Man is much in the same vein, really. Only that album follows the entire album is built around the Gingerbread Man song, you know, the tune of, you know, You Can't Catch Me, I'm the Gingerbread Man. But they do it through 10 and again 10 different character studies. So on the Gingerbread Man, we have the Weaver, the Dying Oil Man, the Confused Transsexual, the Sold Out Artist, the Aesthetic, the Old Soldier, the Aging Musician, the Butcher, the Old Woman, and Ginger's Lament. So I'm just going to play you some of the Sold Out Artist, and then I'll see if there's any. I think there was a CD-ROM of Gingerbread Man, so I'll see if I can find any kind of footage from that. But we'll just hear the music. We'll just hear the music here of the Sold Out Artist, because I remember that being one of the better tracks on this album. I like the bit in this song where they sing "Everybody Feed the Fat Boy," and I want that to be a phrase. Feed the fat boy. Anyway, let's go. An instrumental version of this. Does he start singing?
Out in the street and under the sun, I kissed his feet and loaded his gun. Sooner or later, everyone does. Everybody feeds the fat boy. Everybody feeds the fat boy.
They just don't get it.
I just like that feed the fat boy motif. Okay, well, there was an audio visual project attached to Gingerbread Man, so we might as well have a look at that, and then we'll finish up on Demons Dance Alone and get out of here. I think we've made good time. All right, here's a bit of the video of Gingerbread Man. I mean, I would say this is, if I had to put a label on this period and the very heavy MIDI, it would be this is the Residents' lyrical period. They were very into making sure that you could hear the lyrics on these, as opposed to a lot of their earlier songs where, there was a lot of chanting and obscured lyrics and things like that. So just hear a bit more and then we'll get on to Demons Dance Alone.
Could be a man with $1 million. Only minutes away. Could be a guy with a gun. Only seconds away. Could be a love that will last forever. But if it gets away, there might not ever be one.
Okay, you can explore that in your own time. Somebody is asking in the chat, whether they've been able to make a living doing this. Yes, as far as I know, they've made a living doing this since 1974. They've been and they've made, you know, they've got a very loyal cult following, yeah, they've made a living doing this for a long time. Anyway, let us have a look before I get to the super chats at let's get to Demons Dance Alone, because for my money, Demons Dance Alone is one of their best kind of late period albums. There's this album Wormwood, which is all about it's all songs taken from the Old Testament, you know, reimaginings of bits of the Bible and things like that. I should play a bit of Wormwood just to be complete here. Let's have a look at the Residents. Let's see what I could play off Wormwood for you guys. What could we play? I don't know. Let's where's trying to think of a Wormwood track that's reasonably playable here. Let's just play in the beginning from Wormwood. This will do us, I think. I don't think there's a video attached to this, but we'll hear a bit of this. I won't play it all, and then we'll get to Demons Dance Alone and get out of here. So you get the idea with Wormwood. It's still kind of in this MIDI vein, kind of more accessible sound for the Residents. And then finally, where I'm going to end up, because after this there are a lot of internet projects and things like the Bunny Boy and album called Animal Lover and a kind of late period Residents, which I'm not going to get into. I always wanted to finish here, which I would say is the high point of this lyrical period, this kind of MIDI driven lyrical period in the 90s here. And that is 2002's Demons Dance Alone, which I would say is probably a top five all time Residents record, even including their classic era albums. I'm going to play a number of tracks on this, but the Demons Dance Alone is, as always with the Residents, it's a concept album. I'll just see if there's any lore on it very quickly. Yeah, I mean, it's just got a Robert Graves quotation in the liner notes. It says, an ancient saga tells us how, in the beginning, the first cow, for nothing living yet had birth, but elemental cow on earth, began to lick cold stones and mud, under her warm tongue, flesh and blood, blossomed, a miracle to believe, and so was Adam born and Eve. Here now is chaos once again, primeval mud, cold stones and rain. Here flesh decays and blood drips red, and the cow's dead, the old cow's dead. So that's the liner notes. And all of these songs were written and recorded after 9/11 happened in 2001. And this was kind of the Residents' kind of meditation on that. But it's also got a... it's kind of two parts to the record. There's tongue, which consists of loss and denial, and then three metaphors, and then the final bit is Demons Dance Alone. So let's have a listen to some of their... I would say that Demons Dance Alone is their most accessible album and their most melodic album. So it may be probably the easiest starting point if anybody's interested in, you know, if anyone who hasn't been completely put off by this point, this would be a good entry point. So this guy on YouTube has made video. I don't think the Residents made these videos. I think this guy, Virgil Pink, has made his own videos. But this is Betty's Body from from Demons Dance Alone. Let's listen to this one.
I can be the lover of anybody but her. I can be the lover of anybody but her. I see her every morning and watch her fingers forming shapes that aren't as graceful as a baby's face, full of hope until it turns to a neediness that burns through your heart like it was butter in the mouth of someone's mother.
Betty's body, Betty's body, Betty's body, Betty's body.
A certain scent of perfume makes me think of her room and how I'd like to be there, lightly touching her bare back and gently soaking in the sweet unspoken. I could be her lover if it weren't for mother.
So that was Betty's Body. I mean, there is a number of kind of bittersweet moments on Demon Dance Alone. Here is Life Would Be Wonderful, where the lead singer of the Residents talks about, like, imagining if they had been a more kind of mainstream act. Let's see what this was like.
be wonderful. Life would be wonderful.
If I was a little taller, and if I wasn't quite so old, if my raincoat had a collar to help me keep away the cold, if my little mouse Norman was still alive inside the sun, he used to keep himself so warm and cozy in his cardboard box.
Life would be wonderful. Life would be wonderful.
If I had a nice location to sit where people passing by looked like they was on vacation and helped me buy some pecan pie.
Life would be wonderful.
So that's Life Would Be Wonderful from Demons Dance Alone. But there are a lot of quite, it's a very melodic album by their standards. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. I'll stop there, and you can explore. I've given you a number of entry points. If you like the very weird stuff, I would start at the beginning with Meet the Residents and simply move forward. If you like the weird stuff, but you know you want them to be a bit more polished, you could start with Duckstab or the Commercial album. If you like the kind of pop deconstructions, that there's a very good live show they did called the 13th Anniversary Tour. So try to find the 13th Anniversary Tour. That's not a bad starting point. Or if you like their kind of, I mean, I hesitate to say more mainstream sound, but them at their most accessible and kind of normal, if you want, Demons Dance Alone would be the starting point. Okay, there's tons and tons and tons of stuff I've not touched on. So if there's any like hardcore Residents fans here, this was very much intended as an introduction to an audience who never would have even encountered this band had I not introduced them to you. Okay. They are from the South. They're from Louisiana. The Residents, all four of them were Louisiana guys who moved to San Francisco. Get them in as high quality audio as possible. Obviously me playing it through YouTube is suboptimal. But it was just intended as an intro. Betty was indeed his sister, but of course these songs they're always playing characters, and it's always a concept as well. People saying save yourself the effort and listen to Pink Floyd. This is not a band for you if you're saying go and listen to Pink Floyd. Yeah, indeed, go and listen to Pink Floyd. I don't think any of the Residents would be bothered with that. What else? People are saying, I'm into Nick Cave. Yeah, I like. I actually like some of Nick Cave's middle period stuff. There was an album he did called what was that one kind of late 90s album? Remind myself of the name of it now, because I'm kind of thinking of Resident stuff rather than Nick Cave stuff. But Nick Cave's got tons of really good albums, tons of great albums. But I like that little period there. in the early 2000s, you know, the Boatman's called No More Shall We Part. I like the, those albums there, but the first, I would say like the first six Nick Cave albums, maybe even seven Nick Cave albums are all really good. Yeah. B-Fart, I also like B-Fart. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about Deepest Lore on any of these guys, because they just feel like, I just feel like you're just kind of moving into kind of, the reason I picked Wu-Tang and Residents out is because they actually have lore around them, like actual lore. Not sure if Nick Cave has that as much. Good albums, though. I mean, I might do, what I might do at some point is go, I compile my top 100 artists once, and I just put a huge amount of effort into it. I wrote something like 40,000 words on my top 100 artists. It was a huge, it was basically a book. I could go through some of that one day, maybe, and that might be kind of interesting. So you can see, you know, I'm very, very, very Gen X-y in terms of my very eclectic tastes. You know, there are certain genres I'm not into at all. There are other genres I am into and into all the way. Yeah, and people mentioning Primus, I'm pretty sure the Residents would have been an influence on Primus. They would have been an influence on They Might Be Giants. They influenced Devo. They influenced, I mean, a lot of the acts that have been named in the sidebar, they probably influenced, you know, at some point or another. They are a kind of an acquired taste, as you can imagine. But, you know, it's especially the concept sides of things. I'm pretty down on Roger Waters, to be honest. I'm one of those people who doesn't like The Wall. I don't think that Waters period of Pink Floyd is as good as the earlier period. I'm kind of like not that into Pink Floyd, to be honest. I mean, they've got some amazing albums, don't get me wrong, but I'm not that keen on The Wall. I just think it's overblown. I'm just stream because I understand there's a lot of random comments that I've missed because you know. Okay, all right, let's get to the super chats then. So Years the Eunuch in Entropy says, Skinny is the furtive pygmy. You'll tank me for this once you'll learn the deep lore of Dark Souls. Remember this, the furtive pygmy. No Guard says, any interest in the poetry of Rudyard Kipling, the gods of the copybook's headings, has been stuck in my head for months now. I mean, Kipling's an interesting figure. There's this reactionary band called, what are they called? Or they're even more, they're kind of more on the Wignat side of things. But Zurius, I think they watch this channel. They certainly follow me on Twitter. Zurius, X-U-R-I-O-U-S. And they did a number of collaborations with Mark Brahman where they put Rudyard Kipling poems to music. That you should seek out because they're pretty interesting renditions, to be honest. Here's the Eunuch says, in regards to Pink Floyd, Live at Pompeii is the only truly good thing that Pink Floyd ever did, and it's quite amazing. I mean, I wouldn't say that. I think basically every Pink Floyd album up until The Wall is you know, you can't take that away from them. They're all classic albums. There's something about that kind of boomer tier idea that I'm not that into with Pink Floyd. I actually think it's a form of like, I mean, the idea of somebody listening to The Residents and saying, oh, you should go back to Pink Floyd. It's like, well, it's a form of containment and gatekeeping for anything weirder than Pink Floyd, you know? But, you know, I'm not one of these people though, who doesn't like any mainstream bands. I mean, I like the Beatles. I think the Beatles are unironically brilliant. And I like Bob Dylan and I like David Bowie. I mean, they're all pretty, you know, mainstream these days. I mean, I could easily do Deepest Lore on any of these acts. But I'm trying to go for ones that people might not know as much, you know. But maybe the top 100 artist thing is something I might do in time. I mean, it would take hours and hours and hours to go through all of that stuff. And I just don't know if anybody's interested to know, you know, what my 17th favorite Lead Belly track is and things like this. You know, if you're into the Delta Blues stuff, there's a great Skip James album from the mid 60s when they dug him up. Like all these Delta Blues artists disappeared. You know, they kind of fell on hard times in the Great Depression, disappeared into normie lives. And then in the 60s, these folk revivalists went and like found them like living in like, you know, sheltered accommodation. And they kind of dug up these Delta Blues artists and made them record stuff, stuck a camera in their face and said, like, you know, sing for us, black man. And there are some phenomenal stuff made in the mid 60s there if you're into the Delta Blues stuff. Anyway, Beefheart may be one I'd be tempted to do because I think Beefheart is pretty inaccessible and I'm more interested in this sort of thing. Jacaranda Plus with $100 Australian, which is probably about 10 English pounds, but thank you very much for that. Jacaranda Plus, it means so much. Says, would you be interested in doing a stream with the leader of the People's Party of Australia? They're a right-wing populist party. I think would gain a lot from a discussion on how right-wing populists and elitists can help each other. I mean, I wouldn't be against speaking to somebody like that. You know, I'd have to check out more about who this People's Party are. You know, because I have to be careful about, like, I don't want to be too much on the radar that, you know, the Australian left wing starts going after my channel or anything. But, yeah, I mean, I'd be open to it. Send me some details on Twitter. That's the best way to get hold of me. Meganese Ashan says, I'm super sorry, gave the name of the wrong Huron song. The name of the song is Emerald Star. So, Huron Emerald Star. So there we go. EC90 says, AA, you should look up the Australian band TISM, T-I-S-M. So yeah, people can look up them. Harrison Wade says, every time you mention the event, I think of the Mitchell and Webb sketch, Remain Indoors. Chris Lutio says, AA, you should stream on how to reconcile the development of technology and a traditional society. Are they mutually exclusive? Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about that a great deal. I may make a video. This stream has taken a bit longer than I had intended, but I want to make a video refuting the carrot pill over the next day or so, because I want to kill this meme. I want to kill the carrot pill. And after a few Twitter arguments yesterday, I think I've finally put my finger on what I don't like about the carrot pill. So I'm going to lay that out in a video. I think the traditionalism versus technology is a very difficult nut to crack. I want to think through why I don't like the carrot pill more and lay out my thoughts on that. And maybe I'll come to some realization on that. Adam N. Hobbs has given me £2 to say, resist the vax. So there we go. As expected, I didn't expect this to be one of my more popular streams. In fact, I'm bloody surprised that over 200 people are still watching this, but, you know, probably more people watching this than go to the average residence gig, to be honest. Benjamin Shergarworth says, press one if you're a chub. Yeah, I'm expecting to see a whole stream of ones in the chat. Press one if you're a chub. Come on. Let's see them. Come on, chubs. yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to see what people like Dee and Pharaoh and stuff made of my deep dive on the Residents here. You know, I had booked these solo streams to go back more into wrestling, and I lost the impetus to do that. And so I've done these ones on Wu-Tang and Residents instead. So maybe I'll keep this going like once every 3 weeks or so, do a deep dive on some sort of music act. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. If you've stuck with it for the whole 3 hours, that's rather incredible, to be honest. But it's time to get out.